and he is much more an expert on subject than I could ever be, so I've outsourced the IT outsourcing module to somebody who knows it better than I do. So I'm going to let you begin.
What she's not telling you is she also wrote me an email saying, you can do whatever you want with this section. And I took her up on that. So we will now spend the next hour doing Mickey Mouse imitations.
All right.
I've put together, I've had a look at the readings that you have for this week. I haven't seen the stuff that you've been reading earlier in the course, but I do know what you've been reading this week. And so I've had a look at that, and what I've done is I've taken that and I've kind of put it together with some of the stuff that I know about networks and a little bit about technology. I'm not going to give you one of those here's blogs and here's wikis and here's Facebook's kind of lectures, because that would be crashingly boring. So what I've tried to do is put together an argument around these topics. I don't know if the argument's going to work. It might not. We'll find out. But I figured it's worth a try to see how it goes. So I'm just trying these ideas on for size, and we'll see where we go with them. I want to keep this really informal. I got lots of stuff to talk about, so I could just speak without stopping or even breathing, but I need to do that, and you should kind of pace. So feel free to stop me, interrupt me, ask questions, interject, etc. I'm not wedded to the sound of my own voice, and if we go completely off track and down a different path, that's cool too. I don't mind. So this session's for you guys. Go ahead.
Should we take notes or?
Well, I don't know.
Can you copy the test? Other slides?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Probably. Well, who knows?
This is the way I work, and it actually kind of ties into the topic a wee bit. The slides, such as they are, will be available online on my website. I'll give you the link to my website at the end of the paper. You can take those slides, borrow them, do whatever you want with them. I have to say that because I've done the same with other people's slides to create these slides. That's how it works these days. The audio, I always record audio, and the MP3 of that will also be available on my website probably sometime this evening, maybe this afternoon if I'm real fast, but I'm not counting on being real fast. So probably this evening, if not this evening, definitely by next Monday. So you don't need to take notes unless it's for ammunition or something for your comments or anything like that. Sounds good? Will this be on the test?
We should just cancel it.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
See, I haven't organized the test yet. We'll see.
Okay. So let's get going with this.
Is that too dark, guys?
So.
You okay? Okay. Is that too dark for you?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
So I've tried to wrap all of this around the theme of four struggles, and this theme will emerge only at the very end of the talk. But I thought it was a neat title, so I thought I'd put that there. Here's basically where we're going to go with this. I'm going to talk a little bit, ever so briefly, because you have already read this stuff, about the premise of globalism and content from the reading that you had. And I've completely forgotten who wrote that, I'm afraid. Who wrote that? But I want to know.
Who wrote what?
The handout.
Oh, Dr. George.
Doctor.
The handouts are coming mainly, it's a network
right.
from around the world, and this particular individual is from the University of St. Thomas in Houston.
Okay, Dr. George from the University of St. Thomas in University of St. Thomas in Houston?
Yeah, Houston, Texas.
Okay, so there you go. So I'm going to draw from that a little bit. Then I'm going to shift from that discussion into a bit of a discussion drawing from various sources on how governance has changed through history, and tie that into the rise of networks and talk a bit about the properties of networks. And then in the grand conclusion, which by then may or may not work, draw that out into contemporary conflicts, the four struggles, which is the theme of this paper, this presentation, and draw out implications from that for the choice of technology for these kind of global outsourcing things and similar sorts of projects. Oh, I'm glad that you were leaving. You weren't. It's always a risk when you do talks, and people can and do vote with their feet. I guess you guys are more captive, aren't you? I look at the teacher. I'm just kidding. All right, so pretend there's a beautiful picture there that somehow represents globalism. See, this is what I mean. I forgot to put my pictures in. So, whoops. The silly computer is being silly. There we go. All right, so from your reading, they cite Schultz, and they talk about these five dimensions of globalism, and this is a review for you, so I won't linger on it, but I am recording for people who aren't here and who haven't read your stuff, so I have to speak to them as well. That's the thing about this when you're recording, that you're always speaking to multiple audiences. You're never speaking to just one audience anymore. So there are five major dimensions of globalism. The first is internationalization, which is the familiar sort of globalization of markets, of exchange, and of interdependence, interdependent economies, interdependent supply lines, interdependent, well, everything. The second, I find this kind of an interesting one, liberalization, which he characterizes as the easing of government limitations on mobilization from place to place. And I think that's a fascinating thing to look at, because I'm not sure whether historically there has been such an easing. You look at Canada, United States, people used to just go back and forth. And Alexander Graham Bell, back, forth, back, forth. He didn't even know what country he was in. He was just there. Now they're putting up borders. Anyhow, that's all an aside. But, you know, I think it used to be easier to move from country to country. But universalization is the idea of global experiences. I read from that, and it wasn't in the paper so much, but I read from that the whole McLuhan global village kind of thing, where people have shared experiences. The first person to step on the moon, for example, or the Jeep chase with OJ, or Princess Diana. You know, global experiences, and these experiences, of course, are created by the existence of a global communications network. The fourth is westernization or modernization, or as I call it, McDonaldization. The institution of Western, usually American, political, cultural, and social values around the world. Some of these are what we would call good, things like democracy, freedom, etc. Others, such as Disneyfication, less good. And then finally, deterritorialization, the idea that there's a common social space. And this is a very interesting concept. And it's the idea that your location on the planet doesn't matter anymore, that you can still have a common space with people who are scattered around the world. And the example, and this is, I could tell right away this was a politics slash business thing that I was reading, because there was the obligatory picture of Second Life as an example of a shared social space, which is kind of ironic because, of course, Second Life, the space in Second Life is totally owned and commercial. I'm assuming this is Second Life. I see people peering at it intently. It is, yeah. It looks like it to me. It just doesn't look like the others. Go ahead.
Can you tell me, as the instructor reading this, I've never heard of Second Life before.
You've never heard? Okay.
No, am I?
How many of you have heard of Second Life?
I had no idea what that was, and I was terrified someone was going to ask me.
Oh, yeah, this is not interesting. If I have the internet, we can go into it, but that would take too much
time.
That
picture means nothing to me. I don't know.
It's because you're looking at a very sharp angle.
But still.
Second Life is a quote-unquote three-dimensional virtual environment that people can go into. You log onto it with an application and you enter this environment. And it's a multi-user environment, which means that when you're in it, you are able to interact with other people in the environment. And it's an avatar-based environment, which means it's graphical and exactly. You can dress up.
You can do things you wouldn't normally do.
And do things you wouldn't normally do.
Like fly.
That's a new movie. All right. That's enough for me. I had no idea where it was. Okay.
Idea.
So Second Life is a commercial product. It's produced by a company called Linden Labs. Today they are being evil because they're... Never mind.
Okay.
There's always,
I had no idea. That's
There are other environments like this. For example, World of Warcraft, which you may have heard of, is a very similar sort of thing, except instead of... Like Second Life is like totally social space. You don't really do anything in Second Life except socialize or go to the casinos or whatever. And people in Second Life build things, and then you go tour the things that they've built and things like that. World of Warcraft is a great big game.
People have a lot of time on their hands.
People have a lot of time. And money.
Yes.
World of Warcraft, you have to pay... For EVE Online is a space battles kind of environment. So I actually grew up. Well, I haven't fully grown adult at the time, but in these environments, in what were called MUDs, multi-user domains, and they were text-based multi-user environments. You don't see them anymore. They're still out there, but who does text anymore? Right? I was a wizard in a MUD called Mud Dog. It was based at the University of Florida. But this whole idea of shared social spaces is really relevant because, people in these environments can be from anywhere in the world, and you don't know where they're from unless they tell you, right? Especially in the text-based ones, right? There's no accent, there's no anything. Second Life now supports audio communication, so you can kind of pick up accents and guess, you must be Russian. Something like that. But even there, it's still really hard to tell where people are from. And what happens is it creates this space that's, it's like the Ethernet. People represent it as being virtual, away, not part of reality, and you have your own new customs and new common shared knowledge. And so, there's this idea of this virtual space that transcends physical space, and it's a type of internationalization, of globalization. And interestingly, and I think there's a picture of the internet. And this gives you an idea of the magnitude of this shared social space, and it gives you an idea of the shape of it and of the complexity of it. The different colors represent different networks. So you have AOL, you have Yahoo, Google stuff. Well, Google doesn't really show up as big there. I suppose with all the blogs and Blogger and that. So, anyhow. Oops, have I missed a... I may have missed... Well, I just want to bring this up, because Schultz says the only relevant one of these dimensions, so far as globalization and outsourcing is concerned, is this shared social space. And I find that fascinating and importantly wrong, but building the argument here. So what's happening in this social space outsourcing? Well, the first phase of this, and we've seen this, and that it happened, and it's still happening, is IT outsourcing. And as the chart there suggests, IT outsourcing is when you outsource certain components of your IT to entities that may be somewhere else. And you might think, that's kind of weird and silly, but how many of you have Google Mail or Hotmail? Yeah, almost all of you, right? So you have, as individuals, outsourced your IT services. You've outsourced them to Google, and your mail is actually being hosted in a foreign country. We assume it's the United States, but in fact, it's irrelevant, isn't it? It wouldn't really matter. And similarly, other aspects of IT can be outsourced, from data storage. There's sites out there like Amazon Web Services. If you're ever online and you're going to one site and you see AWS pop up and it's sitting there, AWS, loading from AWS, that's Amazon Web Services. Companies, websites outsource hosting of media files on Amazon Web Services. Why not? Amazon has the bandwidth, they have the storage capacity, they sell it cheap, you buy it, you don't have to have, you know, terabytes of hard drive space. I do that with my own website, except I'm cheap, I don't pay for it. That's not true, because I'm a Flickr Pro user, so I outsource my photographs to Flickr. But I don't pay for SlideShare because I am cheap. Although I suppose if they charge me and I, never mind. Anyhow, you get the idea, right? Common, ordinary, everyday IT services. And just as individuals can do that, so can companies, so can governments. This is reacting very slowly today. So, anyhow, they describe in this paper, and I found this worthy of note, and I found this very interesting, four major models of outsourcing. Conventional outsourcing, where one company or one person contracts with another, and that's like me with my Flickr, right? There's a little contract, and I give them money, and they agree not to destroy my pictures. Also, you can have a joint venture, so you have a company here, a company over there, and they agree to partner on something. And that happens a lot. It happens especially in manufacturing and supplies, where a company will manufacture parts or will manufacture raw materials, and they're in a joint venture to ensure a market for whatever it is that they've created. Build, operate, transfer is kind of a weird one, where somebody out there takes a risk, they build a whole infrastructure, set up the supply chain, all of that, and then sell it, lock, stock, and barrel, to the company that's done the outsourcing. And then finally, the captive center, very interesting choice of words, funny choice of words. I remember, aside, I was working for a Assiniboine Community College, this consultant came through, and you know, consultants, they just breeze through, they're here, they're gone. And so I was chatting with him outside, and we were talking about IT, and computers, and networks, and all of that, and we started to do the same work, and sort of listening to him. Well, you're captive then, aren't you? I said, well, no, I have a job. And it's funny, the consultant thought of somebody who had a job as captive. Fascinating. Anyhow, has nothing to do with what I'm talking about, but I thought it was an interesting way of looking at the world. The captive center is a wholly owned subsidiary. I'm tempted to make remarks about the Canadian government, the U.S. government, but I won't. But you get the idea, right? You can have a company here that has a wholly owned subsidiary in another company in another country that does producing for them. Now, the reason why I thought this was relevant, that this particular slide was relevant, was that all of these presuppose kind of a certain model of organization and structure, don't they? They're all about companies, they're all about owning, they're all about production, that sort of thing. They're, in other words, forms of business organization that are very familiar to us today. None of these things would surprise us. We wouldn't think of any of these sorts of things as unusual. One company contracting with another company. One company owning as a subsidiary another company. It's ordinary business. And it strikes me as odd, and it struck me as odd when I read it, that the future of outsourcing would look like ordinary business as we know it today. How could that be? That doesn't make sense. But where is it wrong? Well, so now we have the second wave of outsourcing that they describe in the paper. And this is not just the outsourcing of IT, but this is the outsourcing of work itself. Or, as the slide says there, the commodification of work. And there's a couple that they talk about, or he talks about in the paper, subjective skills and know-how, and trained labor. And trained labor is my rephrasing of what they said. I added a third, because we're in New Brunswick, and I kind of had to add this third, which is the service function, better known in New Brunswick as call centers. And, you know, that's, for us, that is outsourcing. And it's interesting because we always think of outsourcing, especially here, you know, in the Western economy, as, you know, India or Ireland or Israel. But outsourcing for us is the business down the road. The business down the road is the, well, in Moncton anyways, is where I live, is the America Online Call Center. That's the outsourcing. The outsourcing is the local business. He raised four issues with respect to outsourcing. I'll just briefly name them: cultural factors, geographic distance, infrastructure and security, and morale, which just kills. And I put the question mark there because, again, those are in issues that you would expect of ordinary businesses running in ordinary ways in faraway places. But it's not clear to me that those are the genuine sort of issues that are going to be faced in a global economy. So, set that up. So far, so good? You're nodding, that's good. That means I get at least a B. Okay. So, first of all, here are some criticisms. And then I'll spend the rest of the time backing them up, more or less. And the first thing, and it's a kind of a minor point, but this model, which is based on bracketing out, bracketing, just as an aside, is a technical term. It's from philosophy, a guy called Edmund Husserl. And what it means is taking some issue and setting it aside and focusing on something else for now. We call that bracketing. I love the term because I like to do that. And what the authors have done here is go ahead.
Wouldn't that be sort of like compartmentalizing?
Sure. Yeah.
Like a synonym?
Yeah, that would work.
Okay. Thank you.
So we've put aside issue and the other aspect of globalization, focused on this one aspect of the five. I look at that and the liberalization aspect, I thought that was a funny name for it. One of the major criticisms I have of globalization is that everything gets to be globalized except people. Capital globalized, no problem. Industry globalized, sure, go for it. Trade globalization, yeah, rock on. People, no, we can't have that. You're born in a country like, say, Ghana, generally you stay in that country. You do not follow the markets, right? You do not follow the jobs. Only in big countries like Canada or big entities like Europe or the United States can that happen. And it's interesting, if you take the other dimension of globalization, liberalization, and add it to our picture of globalization, then suddenly the picture changes. Again, look at New Brunswick. People in New Brunswick are not staying here and going online to do call center work at low wages. I mean, they are some, but mostly they leave because they can. So the premise that in a globalized economy, people will just stay in India and Ireland and Israel, Indonesia, had Dad and I, and just be happy doing that, there just seems to be something wrong with that premise. And so there's the beginning of a tension here, right? There's globalization, but somehow we've managed to preserve these older structures, these nation states that we'll use to control the movement of people so that they don't all go to where the jobs are. So you can have high-wage people here and low-wage people here. So there's a bit of an issue there. All right. Second thing, and even more importantly, and I think this is related, the model that they've given, that George has given in this paper, is not, I argue, sensitive to the transformative impact of global networks. The very way we are organizing business and society is changing. And they're changing in ways that make that model that we read about false. So that's the argument. I've got maybe half an hour to pull it off.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So let's look at change in governance. And there isn't an end there. There are different ways of looking at this, and I'll present to you two or three ways of looking at this. I don't need to get this exactly right, and the people I'm quoting don't need to get this exactly right. We just need to get it kind of right. If we get it kind of right, we've still made the case. So we see in Adler and Heckscher changing forms of social organization. The hierarchy, which was, you know, the old form, authority, control, king, god, etc., moving through during the Industrial Revolution, Adam Smith, markets, prices, capital, through to the modern age, which they characterize as the age of community, where we have an economy of trust, of sharing knowledge, of social capital. I hate the phrase social capital. Leave that aside. And this is a ridiculous slide, but I just wanted to draw out and show these three forms of community that they talk about. The community in a hierarchy, the community in a market, and the community as in itself the dominant principle. The general idea here is that there's a progression that happens, and it's a progression from some kind of authoritarianism to various types of post-authoritarianism. And this is significant because the dominant principle of our times, which is often described as the markets or the marketplace or a market economy, is not the end point, that we are in fact moving out of that phase and into a new phase. I characterized it this way. Sorry about the hand-drawn slide. I characterized everything that came before us as groups. And of course, you know, different kinds of groups, you characterize them in different ways. But what we've got coming today as networks. And I've tried to capture this distinction between the old, more authoritarian-based forms of organization and the newer non-authoritarian forms of organization in this distinction, groups and networks. And as you can see there, there are different properties and different aspects of groups and of networks. Groups, for example, tend to focus on homogeneity, sameness, everybody marching to the same tune, to the beat of the same drum, singing the same song. But networks focus more on diversity, people having their own values, their own beliefs, their own objectives, their own goals. Networks focus on order, conformity, doing what, or not networks, sorry, groups focus on order, conformity, doing what you're told, working as a team, whereas networks focus on autonomy, people making their own decisions for themselves. So groups are forms of governance, networks are forms of non-governance. Groups tend to be closed. There tends to be a clear dividing line. You're in the group or you're out of the group. Networks, not so much. You might be in, you might be out, you might be half in, you might be half out. We don't really know. Groups, the form of decision making is one of mass. It's a property of one is propagated through to the rest of the group. For example, in a democratic election, a person might say, I have the theory of international trade, vote for me, and if enough people support that, that becomes the theory of international trade. In networks, decisions are made as a consequence of the interactivity of the members of the network, and if there is a decision made by a network, it's not the result of one person in the network propagating and promoting an idea, but rather it arises out of, or as they say more technically, it emerges from the organization or the structure of the network. That's a hard concept, but think of it this way. You have a television at home, right? And one day, maybe in the past or maybe in the future, there'll be a picture of Richard Nixon on that television. And you know, because you know about televisions, that this picture is made up of little pixels. Now, what you are seeing on the television, strictly speaking, are little pixels. But, and importantly, the little pixels are not little tiny pictures of Richard Nixon, right? They're just little dots of red or black. But the way they're organized allows you to recognize in that pattern a picture of Richard Nixon. And networks make decisions in the same way. No individual pixel in a network makes a decision. It's not the idea of a pixel that propagates. Rather, it's the organization of a whole that creates the decision. Kind of a tricky concept.
When you said that groups versus networks, like the groups are the old or archaic, what's the time frame? Because, I mean, on it, it says today and the future.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, how old is old? You know, how...
Well, and that's a good question. And, you know, and it depends on what aspects of groups I'm talking about even. You know, the authoritarian character of groups is something that we have from prehistory that we still have in some places today, but it's kind of on the lane, right? But other aspects of groups are more recent.
I like your analogy with the salad bowl. But is, okay, so the salad bowl is supposed to represent the network in general, but the individual ingredients keep some consistencies, so it's more like groupings of groups.
Yeah,
exactly. As compared to, let's say, a chili, where you just mix everything together.
Yeah, the phrase that I like to use, and I'm stealing it from Joe Clark, is community of communities. And when we talk more about structures of networks, we'll sometimes talk about small worlds networks. So you have a small network, a tightly clustered network that links to other types of clustered networks. I'm not going to get too deep into that at all because I can't. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There are aspects of both, and they don't necessarily go away, and they aren't always necessarily oppositional, but they are two different things. They're two ways of drawing out characteristics of organization. One, which is more characteristic of the past, the other, which is more characteristic of the future. So here's another model talking about the same sort of thing. There's the dates you wanted. And this model is more complex, and therefore I like it more than mine. And it's the TIMN model, tribes, institutions, markets, and networks. And again, it has that same sort of flavor, right? And now here we're pulling apart the aspects of authoritarianism that we typically associate with tribes and tribal leaders and institutions, you know, dictator for life. We're pulling those apart from the market kinds of organizations that we're more used to, but we're also pulling apart or drawing a distinction between these market forms of organization and networks. You know, and I think this is a key distinction because, you know, we have grown up just surrounded by this whole market ethos. But there's a big distinction between the way a market organizes itself and the way a network organizes itself. A market, a collection of atoms, a collection of individuals, organizes according to mass, organizes according to number. And there are different ways of doing that. You can get lots of votes is a way of mass. Many fans of a rock star is mass. Having lots of money is mass. Networks are different. They don't order according, you know, they don't order by massing things up. They order themselves, organize themselves by the connections that they make. That's why something very small, that is a network, can take on something very large, that is a market. Which is, just as an aside, how small little groups of organized people can take down an entire stock market. End of aside. But it was a pretty cynical one. So, here again are the four different TIMN forms. And again, sorry about the slide. It's kind of awful. But I borrowed it, again, from David Runfeld here. And especially notice the distinction between markets and networks. Markets are atomized. Networks are web-like. Markets talk about social equity and exploitation. Issues for networks, maybe information overload, deception. I am going to say the big issue for networks is cascade phenomena. And they'll come back to that. Again, more on the stages of social evolution now. What Ronfelt is saying, and I'm not completely convinced of this, although I think he may have a point, is that these things don't just automatically replace each other, but rather they're cumulative, they're aggregative. That's not a word, is it?
Yeah.
Well, it is now. They're aggregative. So, you know, you had tribes, and then after you have tribes and institutions, now you have both tribes and institutions. And then once the industrial age comes along, then you have tribes and institutions and marketplaces. And I think there's a point to that, and there's a slide later on which we may or may not get to, where I talk about conflicts. Remember, the whole thing is about the four conflicts, right? We talk about conflicts in these different ages, and you have different kinds of conflicts, and you have different kinds of organization, tribes, markets, networks, and what will happen is people who are in one conflict in one kind of organization will take sides in another conflict in another organization to try to prop themselves up in their current conflict. Horribly messy. I'll give a couple of examples. That's part of the argument I'm not sure will work, but we'll see. So here's another representation of the same kind of thing. This time it's coming from Lipnack and Stamps on virtual teams and virtual teaming. It's a concept you may have run across before. If not, there's a whole school of thought dedicated to this. And again, you can see the evolution of these things, small groups to hierarchy, which are our institutions, bureaucracy, which is characteristic of our markets, to networks, which is characteristic of our new forms of organization. Same kind of progression, emphasizing different points, but still kind of hitting the same elements in history, right? This is what I mean. You can sort of get it kind of right, and you'll still be on the same track. And the same track is the big change that's happening right at the end as we slide out of institutional / marketplace / democracy / mass forms of organizations into the new network kinds of organizations. So far, so good? All right. Nobody's left yet. I love a captive audience. I should do this more. Do my next talk in a prison. Yeah. Sorry. We each have our own things that make us happy. All right. So, networks are so important. What are networks? Networks at heart are incredibly simple. You know what they are. You see them all the time. Networks are composed of basically two major elements, a node and an edge or link. A node is a thing, and an edge or link are the things that connect them together. What makes a network, what makes a link or an edge a link, in my view, is that a change of state in one node results in, or can result in, a change of state in another node. It's not simply proximity. Right? It's not simply similarity. It's actual connection between the two elements so that what happens in the one can actually affect what happens in the other. That's what distinguishes networks from the more open category of relations. So things can be related. The simple fact that they're related doesn't mean that they're in a network. They actually have to interact with each other to be in a network. So let's look at some of them. 6 degrees of Muhammad Atta. I mean, this is almost what prompted a lot of this sort of discussion was the realization that small terrorist networks could make the world's largest military nation ever assembled tremble in fear. Which is kind of ironic, but again, you know, it's this mass versus organization. Organization wins. And it's been interesting watching the response to that. But not just that. People talk about the military-industrial complex. Here's the industrial complex. Memberships of boards of directors. And you know, if you've ever seen the website up there called They Rule, you'll see even larger descriptions of the links among the various boards of directors of various corporations. They're very tightly linked. Online social networks, these are networks that you're familiar with, right? If you have a Facebook account or
less likely a MySpace account, or even less likely an ORCID account, or improbably a Bebo account. Any Bebo people here? Nah, I didn't think so. Well, they have one. Facebook? Yeah. That's funny. Networks of personal home pages and linkages between personal home pages. Back in the early days of the web, I used to have the most fun. I'd go to a web page, personal web pages. They were a lot bigger 10 years ago than they are now, and I'd just follow the links from person to person to person. They're very cool. But, you know, it doesn't have to be digital. Airline networks. And it's the funny thing about airline networks, you know, I mean, they are networks. What are you pointing at there?
My home country is Romania.
Oh, your home country is Romania. Okay.
That's
yeah.
For all of you who don't know where Romania is, that's the one on the top, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bucharest, the capital of
yeah.
the areas. And from up here and there is Transylvania.
Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't resist. You bring up Romania, I bring up Transylvania. Here's another network, and again, it's the kind of network that you're familiar with. You use it, well, you don't use this one all the time, but it's the network. And you, now you sort of begin to, you know, you look for networks, and you begin to see them all around. This is a weird kind of network. It's WordNet, natural language processing. It's the interaction between the meanings of words, depending on how they're organized. Well, of course. Is just because one thing changes the state of another thing doesn't mean that they're physical things. The meaning, the change in the meaning of one word can change the meaning of another word, depending on how they're organized. Gene regulatory networks. My introduction to network theory was listening to a lecture by a guy called Francesco Varela, who spoke at the University of Alberta Hospital and spoke on the immunology network. Fascinating stuff. Metabolic networks and the great circle. And that is various, and it's I know that it's not a complete diagram, various biochemical pathways in the human body. The human body is made up of a variety of networks. We are mostly network kind of things. So it's always fascinating when people use other kinds of descriptions to talk about humans. Think about knowledge, for example. What is learning? What is knowledge? Well, typically, people represent that as the accumulation of facts, right? You're going to be given a bunch of facts, and you will learn them. Now, what does learning them mean? Well, getting fact. Well, that's that mass picture, isn't it? That's the supposition that, you know, you get enough facts in you, you will be educated. But brains don't work that way. You don't just accumulate a bunch of facts. And accumulating a bunch of facts isn't learning. Learning, because we are a network, means becoming organized in a certain way, not accumulating more bits of knowledge. Now, the structure of a network has a lot to do with the properties of a network and how well or how poorly a network functions. If you think about it intuitively, you can tell for yourself that networks aren't all the same, that they can function more or less well. Let's imagine, just in our heads, a network. Close your mental mind or whatever. That's a really bad expression, isn't it? Just imagine a bunch of individual nodes. Now imagine that they're not connected at all. Is that a functioning network? Well, clearly not, right? That'd be a really lousy network because there's no connections, no change of state changes anything. Okay, so now, yes?
So would that even be a network if the dots are not connected? Would those just like individual dots or?
Arguably, yes. They would, but you see, it depends on how you look at it, right? This is the thing about the way knowledge is changing. You said it used to be you just accumulated facts. Now everything's different depending on how you look at it. Looking at it one way, it's just a bunch of dots. Looking at it another way, it's a network without any connections, and therefore a really bad network. You can see how both descriptions are true, but both descriptions come from different perspectives. So, yeah, on the days that I'm arguing with people who are pushing market theories and all of that, it's not a network. It's just a market, it's a pile of sand. On the days when I'm arguing with people about different kinds of network structures, it's a network, it's just a really bad one. How's that for an answer?
So that's one of those ways of having it both ways and still sounding right.
But it's true, that's exactly the way it is. So we have a network composed of just nodes, lousy network. Now imagine a network where everything is connected to everything else. Is that a good network? I think so. Imagine this class if everybody was talking at once. Right? You'd be overwhelmed. And you think about it, a change of state that happens in any node would change the state of every other node right away. No intervening links, it just happens. It's kind of like a broadcast where a change of state in me changes the state of all of you, except we're all broadcasters. Kind of like Twitter.
Sorry, that was a silly joke.
How many of you are on Twitter? Maybe there is truth to that statement. I was reading recently an article that said only adults use Twitter. By adults, they meant, you know, like 25, 35 and older. So here we have a group of people, and I asked, anyhow. For the record, people on audio, three people put up their hands on Twitter. How many of you use instant messaging? Yeah, pretty much everyone. See, it's interesting though. Twitter is a network of people who broadcast. Instant messaging is peer-to-peer. And this is kind of where you find the sweet spot in networks, too. And this is the diagram that Varela drew in the University of Alberta Hospital that I found so fascinating. I don't have a marker here, sadly. But so I'll just draw it, and you'll have to imagine it. So here's a chart, okay?
There you go. Is that for the board?
Is that dry erase? Mm-hmm. I wanted to do it. So, okay. So, and I'm just trying to remember what the axes were, but basically, down here, zero connectivity. Up here, complete connectivity. Everything's connected to everything else. And as you gain more connections, you hit a sweet spot of maximal functionality right here, right? Not everybody is connected to everyone else, but there are some connections. So it doesn't look like this, right? It doesn't look like this. It looks kind of like this, right? So, and what Varela was explaining was, this is a properly functioning immune system. This is a dead one. So is this. So, okay. So now we have this idea that we have better and worse networks. Now let me cash that out a bit in network theory. So, I'll stop that.
You might have to skip a little bit.
Yeah. I'm fighting with my slides. Okay, so there are different ways of putting networks together. Here's a network where you have... Stop that. There we go. So this is a network where you have a few nodes with a lot of connections, and you have some nodes with very few. And that creates the classic, what they call power law graph. Here's the power law graph. Right? You have a few nodes, maybe one or two, with a lot of connections, and you have a lot of nodes with maybe a few connections, and everybody else kind of fits in the middle. So this is Google, this is me, this is Joe Podetnik. Right, so lots of connections, a moderate amount, one. So that's what a network that looks like this produces, that kind of graph. Now, this is a different kind of network, and you'll see as we step through these things that there aren't as many connections, that the power law, geez, why is it doing that? I don't know. Well, I do know. It's just, it's having a, there we go. No. Okay, so there's a network, and that second network, this network here, it's a lot flatter. So some networks have what I call the big spike, and what a lot of people call the long tail. You may have heard that expression. Other networks, a much lower spike, and a higher, a more effective tail. Now, the networks that have the big spike are robust to random breakdown. That means if you pick a node at random and break it, the network will probably keep working. The odds are it'll keep working. Break this node, nothing happens. Break this node, nothing happens. Break that node, yeah, you're still fine, right? This is the concept of net redundancy. But they're vulnerable to targeted attack. And this was, well, the 9/11 attack. This was the stock market crash, where just exactly the right thing in the center of the network went out, and the network as a whole goes down. Come on, computer, you can do it. Oh, okay. So, same phenomenon in social networks. In social networks, you can be a hub. You can be the big spike, big man on campus, rock star, industrial leader, whatever. But that's not always a good thing. This is not my slide. Somebody else made this. Thanks for the sound effect. networks that have strong power laws and big spikes and hubs are particularly vulnerable to epidemics, or what are sometimes known as cascade phenomena. When you have networks that have clusters like that, then things can go from one end of the network very quickly. You think about how fast a rumor travels when it's aided by Fox News. That kind of phenomenon, right? Now, if you had a more dense network, a more thickly connected network, more critics, more commentators between the source and the receiver, that rumor is much less likely to go through. It's much more likely to be caught. Computer viruses, same sort of thing. I know.
I think some of them have classes too.
Oh, that's right. So they've got to be out of here at 20 after. I see what you mean. So, okay. One more slide then. Here are the four struggles. Human versus wild, human versus human, past versus future, rich versus poor. The interesting struggles are happening now between these two kinds of networks, the human versus human, and between old form, old organization, the markets, the democracy, the atomization, the massification, and the network. And what's happening is a lot of the time people will shift loyalties. The people who are attempting to propagate a star and cluster network, a big spike network, will go join forces with people who are attempting to preserve a market kind of economy, a mass kind of organization, together in order to preserve their advantage in the new network model of organization. Boy, I really wish I had another 15 minutes, but oh well. So we have this picture of outsourcing. This picture of outsourcing is based partially on markets and partially on what we'll call privileged networks.
networks that are composed of these stars and clusters where you do have stars that control most of the traffic going through these networks. Those kind of forms of organization, though, are opposed by networks that are more distributed but have less of a big spike and more of a long tail. The networks that have the big spike, the networks that are based on market forces and atomization, though, are more vulnerable to failure than the more robust, newer forms of network, the networks that hit that sweet spot. So when we're looking at outsourcing in the future, you're faced with two major models, the model of companies and subsidiaries and power and control versus a model of an organization not based on power and control and massification, but rather organizations, collections, networks of individuals and small groups. They will, in the long run, probably be more characteristic of outsourcing than the company-based model we see today. So that's what, a little over time.
Yeah,
sorry about that.
On the website, because I think that you'd like to see the rest.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, that's almost it. And then these are the points of contention. That's how you'll be able to pick the winners and losers in this battle. And that's my website. So, and I'll post these and the audio up later on. So I hope that was useful, and if not, I hope it was entertaining.
I love network analysis. I'm sociologists are using network analysis, and I still haven't figured out how to do